This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Brian Larson.
We're doing something a little different with the episode this week. Because it's the five-year anniversary of the devastating 2013 floods, we're going to focus on looking back at what happened and look at how communities and people are recovering today.
At $4 billion, the September 2013 flooding is Colorado's most costly natural disaster.
Over a four-day period, 15 to 17 inches of rain fell along the Front Range. To put that into perspective, that's more than a year's worth of precipitation.
And the subsequent flooding that came as a result of that impacted 24 counties stretching from Fort Collins all the way to Colorado Springs.
Helicopter recovery cranked into full gear Monday afternoon. Both Boulder and Larimer counties, north of Denver, were able to resume rescues of people stranded in their homes because of washed out roads.
Waters have subsided somewhat, but it is still a raging river here. Large logs have washed up on shore in a park area I'm standing in, where the water went up at least half a football field from shore.
Severe flash flooding across the Front Range has caused the destruction of multiple homes. Authorities have also reported two deaths, one in Jamestown, the other in Colorado Springs.
Heavy rain grounded National Guard helicopters from conducting additional search and rescue efforts in Boulder and Larimer counties. During a Sunday press briefing, Larimer County Sheriff Justin Smith summarized both the frustration and optimism of the day.
The question I had is how can we ever recover from this? I know exactly, inch by inch, mile by mile, community by community, they're taking this stuff back.
Nine people died and more than 1,800 homes were destroyed or damaged, and many are still recovering from the flood 5 years later.
Right. Now, there are literally thousands of stories that can be told. In this episode, we'll bring you six. We'll look back at the flooding from the perspective of a community's recovery.
I think the community will be able to relax more when we're finished and not live in this, in the middle of a construction zone anymore.
And we'll hear a survivor's story of being one of the thousands of people who had to be evacuated.
A lot of people, you know, didn't come back for 6 months or a year, and a few didn't even come back at all. But for us, I think it was never really a question.
We'll also look at how the flooding changed the landscape and a river. But first, Colorado has experienced devastating floods before. There was the Spring Creek flood in Fort Collins back in 1997. And Erin, longtime residents will remember the Big Thompson flood of 1976. 12 inches of rain fell in a three-hour period near Estes Park, and the flash flooding killed 144 people. From a weather standpoint, more rain fell in 2013, but that's where the similarities end.
For some of the storms that were in our most recent memories, again, the Big Thompson or Fort Collins, those were sort of those pop-up thunderstorms that you, once they occurred, they were done with.
That's Kelly Mahoney, a research meteorologist with NOAA at the Earth Systems Research Lab in Boulder.
In this case, the rain was persistent. It was a little bit more moderate, especially in the first couple of days, but it just kept coming and redeveloping over the same place, kind of aided by the environment that in which it was embedded. The weather system itself wasn't moving very much, and then the mountains were really just locking a lot of the precipitation in place. So we just continued to watch these cells develop on the radar over and over again. And again, in this situation, it wasn't like any one round of precipitation was so amazingly heavy. It was just that it continued to redevelop over the same place for such a long time.
At the time, I remember this relentless deluge of rain felt really strange for those of us reporting it, like it shouldn't be happening. I mean, we are used to living in a dry climate.
You know what? But we weren't alone. Mahoney and her colleagues also felt the same way.
It reminded us, or it forced us, to go back in the records and say, you know what? This thing that we thought was so rare, this sort of multi-day flood event, this has happened in the past. And so people were able to dig out events from the 1930s, the 1960s. And so right off the bat, we had sort of past precedent to say, this seemed extremely rare, or, you know, the kind of thing that never happens here. And yet, if we look back within the century, there are a couple of times within the Front Range, within Colorado, we've seen something like this. So it happens. Is it rare? Yes. Is it possible going forward? Absolutely.
Okay, now, as we mentioned earlier, there are countless stories from the 2013 floods. It would be absolutely impossible to get to them all. So as we started our reporting project, we asked for your memories through our Curious Colorado webpage.
And we heard from several of you, including Lauren Smith in Boulder. When you're evacuated for something like a fire, or in this case a flood, a lot of people turn to family and friends for shelter until they can return back to their home. Mm-hmm. But what if you're brand new to the area?
That's a tough one. And that's exactly what happened for Lauren and his wife.
In May of 2013, my wife and I loaded up our two Welsh Corgis and a 27-foot travel trailer and left our New Hampshire home for good. We traveled 10,000 miles over the next 3 months, from the desert southwest up the California coast to Oregon, through Idaho and Utah, before eventually circling back to the Front Range of Colorado. In September, when we had settled into our rental home in Boulder, the move-in was easy, as we only had with us what would fit in our camper: an inflatable mattress for the bedroom, aluminum camp cookware for the kitchen, and two folding chairs in the living room. When the rain started a week later, we thought nothing of it. By New Hampshire standards, this was just a good multi-day washing. But soon news reports began trickling in that this was not normal for the Front Range. Watching the news as floodwaters rose in the valley some 1,500 feet below our location, at least we felt safe. On the morning of day 3 of the rains, we awoke to an inch of standing water in our apartment. With our limited belongings, we had little to lose. A Sudoku book on the floor was ruined, and the screen on my laptop got condensation that took a couple days to dry out. The big news that we awoke to was that a good section of hairpin turn on the only road connecting us to the outside world was eroding away, and local firefighters were making the rounds recommending that we all evacuate, with no return allowed until further notice. We opted to stay and began rationing our limited groceries. When the rain stopped, there was an eerie, almost post-apocalyptic silence as groups trekked into the damaged section of the road, 4/5 of the asphalt fallen away into the gully below. It wasn't until several days later that we received word that we could creep around the traffic cones, protecting the now temporarily stabilized hairpin, and more importantly, be allowed to return. I drove into Boulder, resupplied on groceries, and brought them home. The devastation was evident on the drive down, with whole buildings sitting askew in massive washes of newly exposed stick and stone. Life slowly resumed a sense of normalcy as the earth began to dry out. We now own our own home in the mountains west of Boulder, and while its position is such that it's safe from flooding, we have been evacuated once in our 4 years here during the Big Springs fire near Nederland. No matter, we're here now through hell or high water.
That was Lauren Smith from Boulder. One of the hardest hit areas in Boulder County was Jamestown. That's where one person died. KUNC's Matt Bloom visited the community to see how the recovery is going.
Jamestown is nestled in the Rocky Mountains about 12 miles northwest of Boulder. The community is divided by the James Creek. Three bridges connect the north and south sides of town.
So this is the Lower Main Street Bridge.
This bridge in particular holds a harrowing memory for resident Tara Schettinger. At the flood's peak, she and a few others were crossing it in a pickup truck on their way to the helicopter evacuation site. Just as they got to the other side, water started rushing over an embankment.
And we started hydroplaning down Main Street, and all the water was going down a driveway into a lower point that would have then taken us into the creek, and somehow David caught his wheels, and we were able to make the turn up the hill.
The bridge was severely damaged, and the other two were washed away. In the days following, TV news video showed the extent of the devastation.
Rivers of mud and rock destroying the town's infrastructure, and there is no official access between the north and the south side.
In the immediate aftermath, 90% of Jamestown's roughly 300 residents moved away. Tens of thousands of volunteer hours and nearly $30 million later, most of the damage has been fully repaired.
If it happened again, yeah, I think we'd be more prepared.
That's David Mant. He was the one driving the truck when the bridge gave way. Since the flooding, he's become the co-fire chief of the town's volunteer fire department.
We've got a lot of extra resources. We have communications that we have. We have a better tower. communications tower. We've got, we're in good shape here.
Nearly everything had to be replaced after mud and rocks broke through the back wall of the old firehouse. But Mann says there's still an uneasy feeling among him and his crew. One of the rooms at the firehouse is now occupied by a licensed counselor.
PTSD is one of those words that's thrown around and just is something that, you know, is always, I always tell quite recent, the last couple of years, understood as a war thing. But I think it's a valid term for all kinds of trauma. Post-traumatic, because trauma comes in all forms. This was a pretty traumatic thing.
You'll hear the same sentiment from those with ties to Jamestown at the Mercantile, or Merc. It's the only bar and restaurant in town. Singer Kate Farmer grew up here.
We played music here before the flood, so I think that playing music here after it feels kind of similar in a way that other things don't.
Her mom moved away after her home was destroyed and has since come back, like many other residents.
But a lot of people moved away, and the newcomers, from what I understand, are really nice people and everything, but it's different.
Every Thursday night, the Merc's owner, Rainbow Schultz, still cooks a big dinner from scratch.
It's always served as our town meeting place and as somewhere that we gather, you know, before and after funerals or when there's a birth or when there's any town event.
It's also where the Army Corps of Engineers and first responders set up their base camp during the flooding.
There was maps on the walls and the door just stayed open 24 hours a day.
Back then, imagining that the town and the Merc would ever get back to normal seemed impossible.
To have gone through that and to have gotten our town back due to Tara and all the help that she was able to get, I mean, we're so much better for it.
In fact, a lot of people credit Tara Schettinger. Not only is she the former mayor of Jamestown, Schettinger is now the flood recovery manager.
I had no idea how long it would take. I've never done something like this before.
Today, the debris is gone. The town's new bridges are higher and stronger. But there are some losses, she says, that can't be rebuilt.
So I think it is something that our community has begun to really put behind us. But it'll never go away. It's a constant reminder. We lost Joe Hallett during the event, and we'll always miss him.
As for the Lower Main Street Bridge, it's one of the last things to be completed. In conjunction with a few final road paving projects and home repairs, work is expected to wrap up by November at the latest.
I think the community will be able to relax more when we're finished and not live in this in the middle of a construction zone anymore. And I think that will just help everybody sort of settle and just, I don't know, feel a sense of peace around where we've been over the last 5 years and be able to look forward again.
I'm Matt Bloom in Jamestown.
Raymond Linda worked at a construction site at the mouth of the Big Thompson Canyon when floodwaters blocked him from going to work. Instead, he turned his attention to helping families in Greeley and Evans whose lives were turned upside down.
I met my friend as she sloshed out of the swollen South Platte at the East Greeley National Guard checkpoint. "Are you ready for this?" she asked. "Yep," I said. We waded into the brown, gray current. "Stay to the center of the street. It's not as deep," she said, as we passed multiple families floating out their soggy belongings in trash cans. Who knew how useful those trash cans could be? My friend's house, two blocks away, now above the receding waters, had been filled halfway to the stairs in the split level. Today's goal, get everything out of the basement and on a pile in the driveway. Then, sift through for anything worth cleaning up and saving. Broken glass was the greatest hazard, not to mention the hidden manholes out on the street. The lids had blown off and created quite a hazard. Our friends were going through a very stressful triage of stuff, tossing possessions onto a pile to be hauled away, trying to stay focused on a current plan of action, and not to be totally overwhelmed with the vast rebuilding coming. Everyone else in the neighborhood was dealing with the same thing. Some folks down the street had their mobile homes washed away, and they were quite literally homeless. I found myself in East Greeley needing to do something. I had the time. I myself was off work due to the flood near the mouth of the Big Thompson Canyon. For days it had rained, and it was all I could do to climb the slick, muddy construction hill in my mud shoes. Then the flood came. It blew out the canyon, taking bridges and roadways with it. I couldn't get back to my work or tools for days. For weeks afterward, I watched helicopters flying in and out of the mountains, rescuing people from mountain communities. I heard many stories of heroics and heartbreaks. It was very heartening to hear all the stories of volunteerism and resiliency, of people being a community, helping each other, sharing what they had, giving aid and encouragement. You know, sometimes when things are at their worst, we are at our best.
Thousands of Colorado residents were left stranded by the floodwaters, only to be rescued by helicopter, the same ones that Raymond Linda saw flying in and out of the foothills. Back then, Aaron O'Toole spoke with one of those evacuees about the experience and recently had the opportunity to reconnect with him.
The town of Pinewood Springs is located in Larimer County between Lyons and Estes Park. During the worst of the flood, access to the town was completely cut off, and most of the community's 600 or so residents found themselves boarding a Chinook helicopter and being taken either to Fort Collins or Boulder. Kerry Grimes and his wife, Allison, were among those evacuated. I spoke to him by phone then about the experience.
As we were getting on, we were supposed to go to Fort Collins, but the pilot actually said, hey, you know, you're going to Boulder instead.
Oh, okay.
If you don't want to go to Boulder, you can get off, but that's where we're going.
They spent some time at the Boulder YMCA before temporarily relocating to his boss's home, where they anxiously awaited for news on their house and their neighbors. They were relatively lucky. Damage was minimal, and they were able to get back after about 6 weeks. Now, 5 years later, life in the town of Pinewood Springs is mostly back to normal. I met Kerry there and asked him to pick up the story of that day when they realized things were serious.
So it had been raining for several days, and I think it was September 11th, 2013, and I actually tried to go to work. My wife and I kind of discussed it a little bit, but I'm like, I'm going to try to get down to work. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much immediately got blocked off by our volunteer fire folks who said the road has been washed out that way. And then so I asked if I could go up to Estes Park, and they said, nope, you can't go that way either. The road's been washed out. So, at that point, I just came back home, and we went for a little hike that we normally do. Mm-hmm. And immediately, you know, you could just tell things were different. There was little side streams coming down where there had never been before. Yeah. And we crossed one little, that used to be like a little stream, and it was a kind of a river, and we crossed that. And then we got to the main river, and it was just an ocean of, you know, almost like waves and rocks and just trees, and it was kind of spooky.
That river he's referring to is the Little Thompson. Normally, it's not much more than a trickle, but when he and his wife Allison walked down there with their dog on that Thursday, it was a very different river.
When we first got down here, this bridge over here on the right had just washed out, and we could see the residents on the other side of the bridge standing there, mm-hmm. and they were actually isolated. So we actually, the community started calling that Kiowa Island, because this road is a Kiowa road. Yeah, they were trapped over there, so this is the early exit out, and the river was too high to cross, probably for weeks. So the residents actually built this ATV trail on the hillside over there that they could at least walk out or get ATV'd out.
I'm going to walk over to the field.
Sure.
I asked Kerry to show me where the Chinook helicopter landed and took off. I was curious what it felt like when they found out it was their only viable way out.
Other people might have different feelings depending on their experience with the flood.
Yeah.
But for me, I mean, honestly, there was a little bit of excitement, a little bit of panic when they said, you know, you have to be self-sufficient for a couple of weeks. That really kind of kicked in, you know, a little bit of panic. But
yeah.
But it turns out we were really only up here kind of trapped for 5 days before the helicopters took us out. So
only 5 days.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the community changed at all since the flood?
You know, I definitely think it got tighter in terms of, you know, most of the houses here are fairly spaced out. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes tough to meet your neighbors. But I think during that flood, I mean, we met a lot of people who we had frankly never met before. When you're out there, you know, digging trenches around houses to for water to, you know, so it doesn't fall into people's houses, you kind of gain that sense of community.
As Kerry continued to show me around, it was obvious that while most things are back to the way they were, some things are forever changed.
We are on the Little Thompson River in Pinewood Springs. Specifically, this is an area that really got hit hard by the flood. It used to be a lot of trees and meadows, and but when the floodwaters came through, it totally wiped out this whole area and uprooted all the trees, and it just became like a rocky wasteland.
Did you always know that you would come back here?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we came back relatively quickly compared to a lot of our neighbors. We were back in 6 weeks, albeit over rough roads, and at only certain times of the day could you make it back up here because they were repairing the road. Yeah. A lot of people, you know, didn't come back for 6 months or a year, and a few didn't even come back at all. So, but for us, I think it was never really a question.
And though they expected fires and not floods, Carrie says he and his wife are now more prepared than they were.
You did say you were going to get a generator. I'm just curious what happened. Did you?
We did, yeah. Yep. I actually got one right after I got back. Haven't really had occasion to use it, though, honestly.
Keep it that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The floodwaters also caused immense property damage along Colorado's Front Range and foothills. It also altered the course of several rivers and made fundamental changes to the landscape itself. KUNC's Luke Runyon visited a few sites along St. Vrain Creek to see how things changed.
There is quite a bit of poison ivy as we go downstream, so I'll point that out.
Okay, good to know.
I asked Sarah Rathburn to take me to a place along the Front Range that illustrates just how differently things look now than they did before the flood. Rathburn studies how disturbances, like floods, alter landscapes at Colorado State University. And she took me to St. Vrain Creek, upstream of Ralph Price Reservoir, the city of Longmont's main drinking water supply.
So when I look upstream, I can see very clear evidence of channel change from the flood. On the right bank, this deposition of this coarse cobble and small boulder deposition was a result of the flood. And on the left bank, then, very, very clear indication of removal of soil and vegetation and scouring down to bedrock. So the other aspect of the flood was that between here and Route 7, there were over 100 landslides. The rain was so intense on hill slopes that have shallow soils and are, you know, not densely vegetated. And those landslides ended up providing a lot of sediment to the river. So they supercharged the river. That sediment ended up then moving down, and hence that erosive nature, that abrasion that scoured the river, widened it. Here, given that this is bedrock on both sides, you can see that the result was very deep, swift water. It removed conifers. You can see some of those that have been heavily scarred, and those are coming down. Floods are beneficial to river ecosystems, and if we can think about rivers as ecosystems, you know, especially places like this that are preserved, but even getting that thinking down into communities beyond just open spaces and preserves, I think would really set us up well for the future and for these big floods that are hard to comprehend, but that they occur.
A little scratchy.
Good to know.
We stopped by the reservoir to meet with Jamie Friel. He's the city's watershed ranger and manages the area around the reservoir. For most of the year, he lives alone up here, surrounded by rocky slopes and evergreen forests. In September 2013, he was on duty.
The day of the flood, I just remember the sheer scale of the thing. It was moving faster than we could really comprehend what was happening to us.
What did it look like around here?
Well, it was incredibly wet. lots of continuous rain. Every gully was pushing water. Everything that had any slope to it was pushing white water, in fact. And then right below us here is the emergency spillway where all the water was going over. And it was like a freight train. Actually, it was more than one freight train. It was several freight trains. And it was quite a sight to behold and to hear, too, because the actual flood that happened up here happened on the 11th, and it was dark, so I really couldn't see what was happening, but I could hear what was happening, and I had a feeling what the next day might be.
I ask Friel if 5 years later he still thinks about the flood.
I have to think about it every day because I have projects and things I need to do every day which have been directly related to the flood, but in a deep sort of way, no. But my body does every year. I go through a, I wouldn't say it was PTSD, but there's a definite cell memory to the beginning of September. So I feel awkward usually in the beginning of September.
This is where the new post-flood channel is. You can tell this used to be a gravel pit. If you look, you can kind of see some of the old pit banks over there.
Downstream, near the city of Longmont, I meet up with Ken Hewson, the city's water resources manager. We're on a pedestrian bridge over St. Vrain Creek. Before the flood, the river didn't flow here. It was a couple hundred yards away. But the flood forced it to change course.
So right here, during the flood, basically you had a half mile wide of chocolate brown water.
During the flood, Hewson took a helicopter up to the city's reservoir to make sure the dam was holding.
He was really able from the air to see the extent of not only what it was happening in the creek, but it left the creek in so many places, creating new channels. And for me, it was the toughest part was we were flying almost to Lyons, and I saw somebody's house floating down the creek and, you know, starting to turn and tear, and to know that was somebody's house and just watching it being destroyed right underneath you was really hard.
He says systems can be rebuilt and the landscape can change, but it's the human impacts of the flood that remain the hardest to comprehend. Luke Runyon, KUNC, Longmont.
Now, for many, the recovery from the 2013 floods has been slow. And like the river we just heard about, some things won't ever go back to the way they were.
You know, Aaron, but one of the things that we heard a lot during the recovery effort was resilience.
Yeah, in some cases, it even referred to building the roads better than they were before the floods. So in that spirit, we wanted to end this episode on a positive note. We bring you this story from our Curious Colorado submissions.
Michael S. lived in Loveland when the rain started. While he did not need to evacuate his family, they did find themselves gaining another member when he opened the door for someone in need.
The day of the flood started like any other day in our lives. My wife and I went to work, and our daughter stayed at home attending her online school. After getting a reverse 911 call to prepare for evacuation, I immediately drove home and just before entering my neighborhood, noticed a small brown dog in distress sitting in the middle of the road. So I opened the door and this little dog jumped onto my passenger seat, took her home with me where I expected to load up the car and leave again with everyone on board. But that was not to be. My daughter told me that there is no more evacuation. Well, that's great, I thought, and introduced everyone to our new visitor. After attending to her needs, feeding and giving her water and a much-needed bath, my wife reported her missing to the shelter in Fort Collins, and the staff told us that the shelter was full of displaced animals. Looks like we've become foster parents, I said, and that evening we returned to the place where I found her, knocking on doors to see if anyone recognizes her. But no luck. And weeks later, we adopted her and named her Terra, which is Latin for Mother Earth. Terra is now part of our family, and our other dog named Spotty cannot fathom to be separated from her. Needless to say, this flood touched so many people from so many angles, and as terrible and as frightening of an event it was, for us, it gave us our sweet Terra.
This has been Colorado Edition. Thanks for joining us for our look back at the September floods 5 years later. Our show was produced by managing editor Brian Larson and me, Erin O'Toole.
Digital editor Ashley Jeffcoat handled the web and also produced our Curious Colorado vignettes. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
Other music in this episode, Ross Call with To the Water's Edge, Dr. Turtle with You're Right, But I'm Me, Fragile Rain by Junya Nishimura, and Mountains from Cellophane Sam.
Our outro music is Reunion by Jazz Har. We'll be back next week with more great stories.
Make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org, or you can do that wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.